Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday the 16th of May, these are our main stories. President Putin is in China to meet President Xi. It's all smiles, handshakes and warm words. The president of Slovakia has called for calm after an assassination attempt on the prime minister.
Let's step out of the vicious circle and mutual blame. What happened yesterday was individual act, but the tense atmosphere of hatred was our collective fault.
Also in this podcast, could there be a red card for VAR, the controversial video assistant referee? China and Russia have put on a display of unity and mutual support during a meeting of their two leaders in Beijing at the start of a two-day visit by Vladimir Putin. Xi Jinping and Mr. Putin signed a statement that promised to deepen their relationship. Since the invasion of Ukraine, Beijing's support has become increasingly important for Moscow. The US had urged China to stop shoring up the Russian economy by buying its oil and gas, but so far there's little sign that Mr. Xi is heeding these warnings. As well as holding talks, the two leaders will take part in an event to celebrate 75 years since the Soviet Union recognized the People's Republic of China. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports from Beijing.
Mr. Putin walked the red carpet to a Red Army song welcome. Thousands of miles away, his troops are opening up a new front in Ukraine. Their success on that battlefield may depend on how persuasive Mr. Putin proves to be in Beijing.
China will always be a good neighbour, good friend of mutual trust with Russia.
Mr. Xi's welcome was warm, but he didn't describe the partnership in lofty terms. 2 years ago, just days before Russia invaded Ukraine, the relationship was said to be limitless. Not now. China has become Russia's lifeline after the West imposed sanctions for its invasion of Ukraine. But Washington claims some of that trade helps build Russian drones and tanks and is threatening to punish Beijing with more sanctions. That puts Mr. Xi in an awkward position. He wants Russia by his side to counter what he sees as the US-led world order. But he also wants stable ties with the West to help his own sluggish economy. There are signs that the war in Ukraine has altered this relationship, and sympathy for Ukrainians is beginning to seep through state propaganda.
When the war started, full-scale invasion started, everybody decided how can he or she help to Ukraine.
Vita Golod, chairman of the board of Ukrainian Association of Sinologists, was in Kyiv when the war broke out and spoke fluent Mandarin. She decided to translate Ukrainian news to put on Chinese social media.
Just to let people in China understand what's going on in Ukraine. Just let them know the truth about this war and trying to fight the Russian propaganda. Because we knew the time that there were no Ukrainian official agencies, media agencies, outlets in China. It was tough emotionally, to be honest, and it took a lot of time. But 100 people were working hard.
Chinese state media claims Russia had no choice but to invade Ukraine due to NATO expansion, and it doesn't highlight allegations of war crimes. Chinese artist Xu Weixin also felt compelled to act as thunderous explosions hit Kyiv in February 2022.
I don't have a weapon, but I have my pen. I've been painting every day since the war began. I didn't stop even for one day. When I got COVID, when I traveled abroad, I still drew every day. Some of my friends unfriended me because they held different views. But what I can do, I believe I'm doing a right thing. I want to be a role model for my daughter.
Neither are censored on state media, which implies a level of tolerance by the Chinese government. This is not likely to result in a major policy shift by Beijing, but Mr. Xi will likely be calculating the risk of standing shoulder to shoulder with what the West sees as a pariah.
That report by Laura Bicker. Slovakia's president has appealed to the country's political leaders not to create an atmosphere of hatred after an assassination attempt on the country's prime minister. Robert Fico remains in a serious condition in hospital after he was shot multiple times on Wednesday while on a visit to the central town of Handlova. The government is describing the attack as politically motivated. A suspect has been detained and charged with attempted murder. President Zuzana Čaputova called for calm while urging politicians to come together to discuss the situation.
Yesterday's attack on Prime Minister Robert Fico is above all a great human tragedy. But at the same time, it is also an attack on a democratic establishment. That's why I'm asking everyone to think about his quick recovery and to take a responsible approach. Let's step out of the vicious circle and mutual blame. What happened yesterday was individual act, but the tense atmosphere of hatred was our collective fault.
Slovakia's Deputy Prime Minister, Robert Kalinak, says Mr. Fico's injuries are extensive. He gave this update on the Prime Minister's condition in a news conference.
Unfortunately, at the moment, I cannot state that the prognosis is positive because the scope of injuries that were caused by four bullets is so widespread. The doctors succeeded in stabilizing the medical state. However, we are still not beyond the risk to the life of the Prime Minister, but we will inform you in the forthcoming hours about the current situation and the progress.
We got more from our reporter in the Slovakian capital, Bratislava, Bethany Bell.
Still in a very serious condition, according to Mr. Kalinak there. And he said that his injuries were complicated. And another deputy prime minister, Thomas Taraba, told the BBC earlier that Mr. Fico had been shot at very close range, wounded in the stomach and what he said was the joint. So this is a time where very many people are waiting for each update on his state of health as he still remains in this very serious condition after a number of hours of surgery.
And a lot of people also waiting for answers to the question, what was the motive? Who is this person who tried to kill the Prime Minister?
Yes, and still very much waiting on the police investigation for that. There's a lot of speculation in the media, on social media, as to who this man was. We understand he's in his 70s. There's a piece of footage, very, very short, showing a man believed to be the suspect, but we don't know whether it is or not for sure, saying he disagreed with government policy and its stance towards state media. But again, that hasn't been confirmed. But all of this is leading to a real sense of uncertainty, confusion, shock in this country. And there are already a number of politicians in Mr. Fico's side who are blaming the opposition. Opposition figures saying that that the sort of febrile atmosphere in this country and its politics isn't helping the whole situation.
Bethany Bell in Slovakia. A decade ago, Donald Trump wanted to build a luxury hotel complex in the Serbian capital, Belgrade. Now his son-in-law has been given the green light to redevelop a building that was destroyed by NATO airstrikes. The Defence Ministry was bombed repeatedly by NATO forces during the Kosovo War in 1999. Jared Kushner, who's married to Mr. Trump's daughter Ivanka, says he plans to turn the site into a hotel. But the project has caused outrage in Serbia, where the ruins of the building have become a memorial to those killed in the NATO bombing campaign. Our Balkans correspondent is Guy Delaunay.
The plan involves, first of all, a 99-year lease. This is between the government of Serbia and Affinity Global Development, which is a company that's founded by Jared Kushner. And what this agreement involves is a little bit, it's still, the details are still being filled in, but part of the conditions are for a memorial centre to be built. And everything that we've heard up until this point, and these discussions have been going on for some time, is that there's also going to be a hotel on the site. Now, this is controversial for a few different reasons. Firstly, as you say, people are asking, why would we have a hotel on a site which has been protected as a cultural monument since 2005 as a memorial to people who died in the 1999 NATO airstrikes? That's one issue. And then the second issue is, if we are going to have any sort of redevelopment, why is it being done in this way, in a way which people do not feel is transparent? There's not been a tender, there's not been any sort of public consultation, and people are asking, when it's such an important site in the centre of Belgrade, why haven't we had more of a discussion about it and how everybody feels about it?
Well, yes, Serbia still describes the NATO bombing as aggression, and many say that this redevelopment could potentially reopen wounds from that conflict.
Or, on the other hand, as Jared Kushner's company says, it could build bridges between cultures. And I was talking today to somebody from an urban development organisation called the Ministry of Space, who are based in Belgrade. And, of course, they're not happy about the lack of transparency. But they do say there's a certain degree of irony involved here, that for 25 years there hasn't been any acknowledgement from the United States that what happened in 1999 with the NATO bombing, which was US-led, very much US-led in 1999. There's never been an acknowledgement from the United States that it did anything wrong. That it's always insisted that the bombings of the Defense Ministry buildings and other sites in Serbia and Montenegro were fully justified in the context of forcing Yugoslav troops out of Kosovo. Now, if you've got the son-in-law of a former president of the United States, and who knows, possibly future president of the United States, establishing a memorial on the site of these Defense Ministry buildings, that, from a symbolic point of view, would be quite intriguing.
Guy Delaunay speaking to Bernadette Keir. Around the world, many people have been affected by the cost of living crisis. In Nigeria, the yearly inflation rate soared to more than 33% in April. It's the highest such rise for nearly three decades. In simple terms, that means the prices for basic goods are rising much faster than people's ability to afford them, causing great hardship for many Nigerians. Ademuwagu is a risk consultant for Songay Advisory, specialising in investments in Africa. He spoke to my colleague, James Copnell.
It's very difficult for many low-income people here in Nigeria because prices are changing all the time. So, for example, my cable TV company has raised prices two times already in the last 1 year. And it's not just cable TV, the cost of the cable TV subscriptions. It's everything from milk to prices at the barbershop to pretty much everything, really. That's what's going on right now. And it's really a hard time for many low-income people in the country.
And what's driving it?
Well, the inflation in Nigeria right now is mostly structural. The question is, what's changed in the last 1 year? So it's moved from 22% to almost 34% in the last 1 year alone. First, there was a change of government about a year ago, about this time last year. And the new government started by trying to cut petrol subsidies. The result was that petrol prices more than tripled overnight. And, you know, the thing about Nigeria is that many people, because grid power is not reliable, so many businesses depend on petrol and diesel and fuel to generate electricity. So the cost of producing goods and services really went up. In order to distribute goods from point A to B, you're going to have to put those goods on a vehicle that's going to need petrol. So prices really went up because the costs of producing and distributing those goods and services went up. Apart from that, the government also, you know, changed the central bank leadership, which then tried to change its foreign exchange management strategy. And the result was that, you know, there were multiple currency devaluations and things like that. And as a result, the currency has depreciated by more than 70%. Last year, about this time last year, the naira was about 400 nairas to a dollar. Today, it's nearly 1,500 nairas to a dollar. So you have a great deal of imported inflation.
Yeah, plenty of problems then. Are there obvious solutions to your mind?
Yeah, I think that's the thing. My opinion is that, you know, when a country is dealing with a big economic crisis, there's a need for some big ideas. So, for example, in the 60s in the United States, when the national poverty rate was almost 20%, President Johnson responded with the war on poverty. That's a big idea. What is Nigeria's big idea to this it's very difficult to pinpoint what that idea is. So what you see is that every now and then the finance minister is on TV announcing this new thing, that new thing. Every week, the central bank is releasing press statements, tinkering with the rules and changing things here and there. But there isn't a big idea around which you can build something solid.
Adedeyu Ademuwagu speaking to James Copnell. Still to come in this podcast. Two years on, how a volcanic eruption in the South Pacific has affected marine life around Tonga. Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Now, dating can be a difficult experience, but the founder of the dating app Bumble, Whitney Wolf Hurd, says artificial intelligence could help you find your perfect match.
You could, in the near future, be talking to your AI dating concierge, and you could share your insecurities. I just came out of a breakup. I have commitment issues. And it could help you train yourself into a better way of thinking about yourself. And then it could give you productive tips for communicating with other people. If you want to get really out there, there is a world where your dating concierge could go and date for you with other dating concierge. No, truly. And then you don't have to talk to 600 people. It will just scan all of San Francisco for you and say, these are the three people you really ought to meet.
Well, that was a vision outlined by Bumble's founder at a recent technology summit. But if that sounds like a dystopian nightmare to you rather than an ideal future, our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, says she thinks it will still be a while before it happens.
We've seen a lot of big advancements in AI tech just this week. You know, we've seen from OpenAI and Google tools that can talk you through a maths lesson and find your glasses for you. But I think we're still a little way off an AI program representing you and representing me, having a chat with each other and then deciding whether they think we'd get on in real life. You know, that is a very sophisticated bit of machine learning. And while the tech is advancing faster, becoming more human-like, I'm not sure that we're going to be there anytime soon. Having said that, we do know that AI is used by dating apps. It's used to filter accounts. It's used within the algorithms that throw up the matches for you. And it wouldn't at all surprise me if people are using chatbots to maybe perfect their profiles or craft that perfect introductory message. So I do think AI already has a role in the dating scene, but not to that extent quite yet.
But what are you going to do if you have to meet in real life?
Well, I think this is the challenge, isn't it? As AI seeks to become increasingly convincingly human-like, and that really is the mission, you know, in order to be truly useful, it's got to be accepted by us, it's got to be like us. But that is a really difficult thing to do. And the thing about relationships is that chemistry that is very, very hard to recreate using computer programming. I mean, I don't know about you, I know plenty of couples, I'm in one, where on paper you have very little in common, but there's something that keeps you together and makes you get on. And being able to get that in artificial intelligence, I just think would be a big challenge for even the most sophisticated AI engineers.
But if you take an app like Bumble, many are available and people use a variety of them. Why is that the goal, to use AI more and more when it comes to romance, do you think?
Well, I think it's about narrowing the pool, isn't it? If you are using a particular app, you're looking for a particular type of person, a particular area of the world, you know, whatever your preferences are, AI is very useful in terms of being able to filter down to exactly the kind of matches that you're looking for. And I think probably also useful in terms of helping you present yourself in your best way. I mean, people use AI tools to write their CVs, don't they, to apply for jobs. You know, it's already being used to help us present ourselves in the way that we would like to the world. So I do think that it's going to get more interesting, isn't it? But then ultimately, perhaps also more disappointing when you discover that the real you isn't as sophisticated as the AI you was.
Zoe Kleinman speaking to Emma Barnett. It's been more than 2 years since the eruption of the Hunga volcano in Tonga, the largest volcanic explosion this century. At least 4 people were killed in the blast, which sent shockwaves across the Pacific. Scientists have been researching the true extent of the destruction, and a new study reveals the impact on marine life. Ella Bicknell reports.
When the Hunga Tonga Hunga Harpai volcano exploded in January 2022, it hit the archipelago of Tonga. A huge cloud of ash soared into the sky, 20 kilometres high and more than 500 kilometres wide. NASA said they'd never seen anything like it, as their satellites captured shockwaves reverberating across the Pacific Ocean, even reaching the shores of Japan and Peru. As well as destroying communities, a new study has found that the eruption had a devastating impact on Tonga's marine life. Writing for Nature's Communications Earth Journal, scientists called the explosion a mass mortality event for sea creatures. They found a thick layer of ash blanketed the seabed, wiping out mussel and sea snail populations that once thrived. It also decimated levels of plankton, a carbon-absorbing organism which plays a key role at the bottom of the aquatic food chain. The Hunga eruption still sparks huge scientific interest.
Offshore New Zealand, we have at least 30 major volcanoes. So by looking at Hunga, which was such a devastating and violent eruption, what we're trying to do is to see it as to why this volcano blew up so violently.
That's Cornel Durand, principal scientist at GNS Science. On Wednesday, they launched a research vessel on a month-long voyage to Tonga for what they plan to be the most detailed survey of the volcano-hit area.
We believe that this eruption was due to sort of, it was a gas-driven eruption, some sort of carapace of minerals that sealed off inside the volcano. As you might imagine, the pressure just built and built and built and boom, up it goes. If that's true, then what it means is that these volcanoes are far more dangerous than we previously thought.
The hope is that these findings will help us better predict when a super eruption might take place, allowing more time for evacuation and saving more lives from these colossal forces of nature.
That report by Ella Bicknell. Since its introduction in professional football around the world, VAR, or the video assistant referee, has, I think it's fair to say, not been loved by many fans, players or managers. The intentions were noble, using video replays to eradicate wrong decisions from the game. But VAR has disrupted the flow of play, leaving fans and players waiting for quite a while sometimes while decisions are made. Now the 20 English Premier League clubs are set to vote on whether to scrap VAR in a meeting next month. So what do fans think? Here's our sports correspondent, John Bennett.
I think many fans have views about VAR that they agree with Wolverhampton Wanderers that it should be scrapped. They have brought forward this vote, which will happen next month. All the Premier League clubs will vote about whether to scrap it from as early as next season. And a high-profile current player, Newcastle and England winger Anthony Gordon, has said in the last 24 hours he doesn't understand the point of having VAR. But the actual Premier League, they're fully behind the system. They argue that since it was introduced, correct decisions in matches have increased from 82% before VAR to 96%. But Wolves, who've triggered this vote, they say that the price we are paying for a small increase in accuracy is at odds with the spirit of our game.
And will they have the support they need? Because they need 13 other clubs to join them for this to pass.
Yes, that's right. It's very difficult to say how many other clubs will join Wolverhampton Wanderers, because it's an extreme solution, isn't it, to totally scrap it from next season. We know certain clubs have felt quite hard done by this season. Nottingham Forest, for example, they released a statement after a game against Everton saying their patience has been tested multiple times. But one thing is clear. I think the actual Premier League, they will argue the case to keep VAR. They feel the system's working, and they also believe that getting rid of VAR would have a negative impact on the reputation of the Premier League.
Especially given that so much has been invested into it, surely the solution is to improve it, not scrap it.
Yeah, that's where I think this will go. I don't think in the end that VAR will be scrapped, but I think this will lead to a wider debate about how it can be improved. And the authorities say they are working to improve it. Worth saying, though, that one country, Sweden, they've become the first elite league in Europe to reject VAR, so it has happened elsewhere.
John Bennett. 500,000 people forced to abandon their homes after they were inundated with floodwater may have to suffer more severe flooding for weeks to come, according to weather experts. Persistent rains mean that river levels have continued to rise in the state of Rio Grande do Sul. Nearly 150 people are confirmed to have died in the past couple of weeks, with dozens more still missing. Dr. Rafael Pretzel is an orthopaedic and trauma surgeon in the state capital, Porto Alegre. He says the hospitals he works at are unable to carry out operations because of the flooding and a shortage of clean water.
One of the hospitals I work on is shut because we have water until the first floor. The other hospital that I perform surgeries, we're not supplied by water on a regular basis. So we have to shut some of the operating rooms, and we have only emergencies and the people that are ready on the hospital, but we are not taking new patients, and everything that is not emergency is on hold.
Well, as the floods continue to wreak havoc and search and rescue operations are going on, two Brazilians hoping for Olympic glory in Paris this July have emerged as unlikely heroes. Alfie Habershon reports.
That's the sound of Evaldo Matthias Becker and Pedro Tuchtenhagen hoisting their boat onto a submerged highway in Porto Alegre. After mass evacuations, the city is eerily empty, apart from soldiers patrolling its streets, with once towering rooftops peeking over the water. But people and pets remain trapped, and the two rowers are hoping to find them.
Evaldo and I talked a lot and decided to give up the pre-Olympics and focus our energy on Rio Grande do Sul, our state, to help our friends and families.
The pair were supposed to be travelling to Switzerland to compete in the qualifying round for the Paris 2024 Olympics. But they say this is more important. And they aren't the only ones to swap glitz and glamour for search and rescue, because an Olympic swimmer and a surf champion have also put aside their sporting commitments to join the operation, as has the coach of the national judo team. But for the rowers, the sacrifice appears to be even greater.
In addition to the water taking away several homes, it also took away some dreams. It was my dream, Pedro's dream, to be able to participate in this Olympics in our category.
Because after Paris, the lightweight doubles skulls category will no longer be an Olympic event. And that means they have given up a lifelong dream of winning a coveted Olympic medal to help those in their home state, caught up in one of the worst environmental disasters ever to hit southern Brazil.
And that report was by Alfie Habershon. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Harry Bly. It was mixed by Daniel Fox. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.